is probably going to be my only public forum, because as I understand it, we're just going to be with the composition seminars.
Except your last talk where you
talk about yourself. Oh, except my last talk where I talk about myself, so maybe we could talk about you. I once caught up a friend and I said, this evening we're just going to talk about you. And so it might be a very apt time if you could ask me questions and about the...
I have a question.
Yes.
There is a painting form known as post-avant-garde, which is quite interesting and does seem to be valid. Certainly critics feel that it's valid. Isn't there some validity in a music form known as post-avant-garde?
Well, I don't know what it means. I'm pretentious in speaking street talk. And to me, post-avant-garde means post-famous names. Essentially, that's all it means to me. Until those names become famous. Just what are you going to do? For example, after Jackson Pollock's gesture in 1951, I mean, what in heaven's name are you going to do? You know? Or just do two beautiful, unbelievable colors, you know, and paint them as well as Rembrandt the way Mark Rothko did with his mysterious edges. The same thing, in fact, getting back to Benita Marcus, I went over to apartment in the midst of writing this, and I noticed that she had a big sign on the right on top of her desk, and it said Feldman-Boulez. And I said, what's that? And she said, that's the enemy. She says, I just gotta remember what I'm dealing with here to be a composer. And I think we hid in the past 25 or 30 years, I think we hid behind this terminology long enough. And I think individually we have to come out and be tested. In a sense, I don't think these names really help any. Good. Modernism, non-modernism. You see. Because I think, again, if we have to find the leader, we have to find the leadership in ourselves. And by finding the leadership in ourselves is know, in a sense, how we can, in a sense, develop fantastic technical facility in terms of doing what we want to do rather than Feldman or Boulez, you see. I think that's essentially the problem now. And the problem is now is not looking for some methodology that could make things easier for us to understand what we're doing. There's a big problem about teaching and being a professor and being well known and handling students who feel they have to know what they're doing. Actually, there's a famous remarks that I made at Yale 20 years ago, where I was invited there to give a big seminar and a concert of my music. And a very famous, one of the most famous musicologists, after listening to my music and listening to some degree, my vague, authoritative way of talking, said, Mr. Feldman, I've come to the conclusion that you don't know what you're doing. And Mel Powell, who was the chairman at the time, still tells me how fantastic it was. It's because I walked off the podium to where this man was sitting. And they thought I was going to punch him in the nose or something. They had no idea what was going to happen. And I said to him, listen, just because I was invited by Yale University to give a lecture doesn't mean I know what I'm doing. And I say that all the time. I never ask my student, what are you doing? I would say, you're not focused. I would use general terms like you're not focused. Or I said, your hierarchical notions, I said, are absolutely ridiculous. For example, if you think that melody is a hierarchical notion, look how mediocre your accompaniment is. You know, that's tossed away as if it's not important. It was the melody they want or something. And I guide them that way. But I never guide them in any way of giving them a certain type of security in knowing what they're doing. I think that's why ideas have taken over so much aspect, especially in terms of university music. In the sense is that they feel that they have to control things and they have to essentially know what they're doing. But I think that's essentially where the problem is. And also I think the problem, another thing that interests me about Benita Marcus is that she makes the distinction between problem solving and solutions. And there's a vast distinction about those, between those two words. And we know that in problem solving, you don't have to know what you're doing. We all solve problems in our sleep. And we solve, and we find solutions when we're awake. So many times my problems, I could be gnawing at a thing. I could be upset for days. I don't know what's wrong. And usually could be what's wrong is that the instrumental combination is not working. You see, and I'm waiting a little bit to get familiar with my material to see if it's some kind of adjustment has to be involved. And this whole kind of consciousness and this whole kind of control, which of course Wagner didn't have, and Mozart to some degree had it intuitively. You know, one of the interesting things when you teach is like the best, one of the most interesting periods I like to teach is before serialism. And that's some of the greatest pieces that Weben and Berg and Schoenberg wrote in those years, where Weben just had this chromatic scale on the edge of a page and was just like picking out notes, you know. That the more the system became formalized and understood, to some degree, there was a deterioration in the art. You know? I mean, there's a perfect period in a sense, and all history has those periods. I think we're all on our own now, essentially. Now, in getting back to America, I feel that the conservatism, to some degree, is... I don't feel that a country could create an art that outstretches its the political climate. I feel that the political climate, no matter how strong anybody is, to some degree, creates some unconscious, we must stop here, some kind of thing. And it's very interesting that in America in the 50s and the 60s, where the political climate, in a sense, after McCarthy, for example, created a new kind of radicalism in the art, as if to say, we can't have anything like this ever happen again. And I think it affected the art too. And I've seen this very true in other countries as well. That one is programmed. I have a lot of Canadian composers that come to study with me. And I find that their work is pretty safe only because they get large grants. And they don't want to rock the boat. And they're being programmed. They don't even realize it. This generosity of helping them out as professionals have made them so careful, and the kind of music they want to write has really affected their music unconsciously. So rather than saying what kind of music is happening in America, um, I'd rather say that I'm waiting for just strong talent to emerge. What I really think is going to happen is that, and I'm using Benita as a model, because I see hundreds of scores all the time, an awful lot of music, is that we might go into a period where the music is not recognizably as either modern or as conservative as her music is. I never get the feeling that I'm listening to Cologne when I'm listening to her, and I also don't get the feeling that I'm listening to West Coast. To some degree, I don't know what I'm listening to. I'm listening to a very private voice with a lot of technique, you see. And hopefully, I'm very interested in creating a kind of intellectual climate by my colleagues, by my teaching, by my own music as an example, to create that kind of music. You know, history is a burden. And the burden is really not to take it on, because a terrific musician, in a sense, has no argument with history. And as T.S. Eliot reminded us, we take from it what we need, and we all do that. But I think that the burden we have of history is essentially getting it off our back as a safe refuge. And I think that was always one of the big problems. I once compared history to, especially people who always bring up history, continuity, tradition, that they're in a bank, and they talk about it as if they're in a cathedral. And by a bank, I mean is that the assets are there just to draw on without really putting anything in it, you see, the way Stravinsky added. I consider this, to some degree, cultural welfare, you know, playing music that just sounds like every other music. Okay, get out cultural welfare and we're going to play your piece next week. And I'm kind of fed up. Naturally, after 20 years, 25 years, you're waiting and waiting and waiting. But I'm certainly not waiting to see this conservatism. Conservatism without technique, actually, that's the worst. Then it's a kind of like amateur night of the reactionary attitudes. That's no good either. So rather than either or, it's neither nor. I don't like amateur radicalism, and I don't like amateur conservatism. You see, I want to hear names again, like I heard when I was 24. Names where someone came back, he said, I heard a piece was like being at a tennis match. I said, what do you mean? He said it was like the sound was going from here to here to here to here. That was John Cage talking about Ligeti. And Earl Brown coming to me and saying, boy, there's a guy in Paris. He just came from Greece. Boy, you ought to hear that stuff. It's far out. And I was an artist. I want to hear names again. And I think we all want to hear names again rather than a return to something again. Sounds like a sermon. Born again.
Yeah. What amount of responsibility do you think does the composer have towards the audience?
None. Why? Because if you haven't got the moral conscience, in a sense, that if the humanity is not in you, you see, and what good is it? What good is it? What good is it to manipulate the audience or to write someone a letter like, look, I want to write a music as if I'm actually sitting in the audience. You know, all the responses, everything. A lot of that stuff, you know, was really audience manipulation. That they were involved not necessarily with a sense of time as it was unfolding, but a sense of timing, in a sense that will give, in a sense, the right kind of response in the audience. Have no idea how many really fabulous people were involved with the audience. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. I recently said to somebody, I said, we have enough music. If we don't have any music for the next 5 years, it'll be okay. I said, what we don't have is enough audience. I'm very interested in an audience, and I'm very interested in a new one. I'm no longer interested in an audience in a sense that wants to hear that which they already heard. This is not an educated audience. And to insist on some interest, you're asking for interest, mind you. You're not asking to take an adult education course. You're asking for interest. Doesn't mean that the music is elitist. I'm a New Yorker. It's impossible for a New Yorker to be an elitist. And then you never know what the audience is or what it is. This is a very true story. It seems contrived for the moment, but it's true and documented. I was having a conversation with my teacher. I wasn't studying at the time. And his name was a fabulous guy. My name was Stefan Volpe. And Stefan came out of a 1920 Weimar Republic. He was Marxist. And he had a studio on, at that time, more so now, one of the more proletariat streets in New York. It was on 14th Street and 6th Avenue. And I brought him a new piece. I wasn't studying with him, but I was still singing and bringing my music. And I brought him a new piece. And he says, Morton, he says, it's so esoteric. You're so esoteric. He said, isn't there such a thing as a man in the street? He was on the second floor. And we're looking down. And who's walking across 14th Street and 6th Avenue? Jackson Pollock. The man in the street. And by Jackson Pollock was the man in the street, and he was nuts about my music. A lot of people have problems with it. A lot of people don't have problems with it. What's interesting about modern music is that if nobody likes it, they just can't shut it off. They have to go on raving about it, against it. I think that modern music should exist, and everybody has the right to just shut it off. Just shut it off. But it should exist like anything, just like I shut off light music or jazz. I'm shutting it off all the time. But as far as the audience and the composer, I don't think the audience really had a chance. I don't know who the hell the audience is. I'm having some very interesting experience. You know, I told you earlier that I asked myself some terrible questions. One, is music really an art form? Or is it just a music form? That means a form that we already know and we feel that the proportions are right and everybody is an expert about it, even though you don't know anything about music, only because it's like everybody else's music. And now, if it's not an art form, what is it? Okay, we're not going to settle this at this particular meeting. We're never going to settle it. Another question that I ask myself is, can we get rid of the audience? How do we get rid of the audience? I was once sitting with a great friend who was doing a string quartet of mine many years ago, and the audience was fidgety, was annoying. I heard some quiet hisses beginning after 10 minutes. And I turned to my friend. I says, what's this I hear about a live audience? I said, there's nothing like a dead one. I mean that generously. I don't know whose fault it is. I don't think it's anybody's fault. Someone once described tragedy for me is when two people are right. But it's a question of, I don't know. It's just a question of, I think it's a power play, really. There's a marvelous Jewish joke I love about Sam owes Ben $20,000. And in the middle of the night, his wife wakes up and sees Sam walking the floor. And And she said, what's the matter? She says, I owe Ben $20,000 and I have to pay him next morning. I don't have it. Hello, Ben, this is Sadie. Sam doesn't have the $20,000, so you walk the floor all night. So, you see, and I think in art too, really seriously, it's a question who walks the floor. I mean, I see tourists coming into New York, going to the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim Museum, the Metropolitan Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, and I see modern art, Madison Avenue, 57th Street, modern art. They feel they're in a lunatic asylum. They're walking the floor in New York, essentially in terms of what's going on here, you see. So I think it depends on the community. Who walks the floor? You know, it's in a place like Cologne, evidently the audience walks the floor because there's official support for it or an element of tolerance. I consider it very much like a newspaper, the cultural life of a country. And though I live in Buffalo, the reason I get the New York Times is because it's a newspaper. And I sit down for an hour and I'm reading this damn newspaper. It doesn't let up. One section after another under every category. And I feel that society must make that available. For example, if they're counting heads in my university because they spent millions of dollars for access to musical facilities which are not used, either by the college students, by the faculty, or by the community, everybody's very upset. So the first thing they want to do is say, take away the funding for modern music concerts. On the other hand, nobody uses the library either. Nobody, I don't think anybody uses anything. In the sense, I think we'll have to just close down everything, essentially. Just ride around in automobiles. So, again, it's a question of who walks the floor. I think the public has enough. I think the public has everything. They got it all. And I think there's an effort that has to be made. And if they don't want that effort, then it's perfectly fine, being that they have it all. It shouldn't deny a public that wants the other, that considers their right to have the other. You see. So it's a big problem. And I don't think it's an artistic problem. I think it's a social problem. I think it's a political problem. And ultimately, I think it's a financial problem. I have no idea. I don't think it's an artistic problem at all. I've had enough experience to realize it is not an artistic problem. I don't think that anybody has the right to already should define what the public likes, doesn't like, and should like. I don't think one has that right. I don't have that right even in my selection when I give a concert. I give a concert across the board, especially in a university. And a lot of people are very upset because of my avant-garde position, and I keep on reminding them, as far as I'm concerned, a university is like a museum. This is not a private art gallery. And I try to keep my music department as a museum with all different kinds of people coming, conservative. The conservatives, when they make a talk, usually sound radical. And when the radicals make a talk, they usually sound conservative. We had John Cage and Aaron Copland come. Aaron sounded like some kind of terrorist. John Cage was more or less modifying his position. The audience. Big, big problem. I mean, if you grow up and saying there's an audience, if you're going up to say, who wants to write music if there's no audience, music doesn't want you. If you need an audience to write music, we don't need you. Again, that was a very long aside, actually, for the point that I wanted to make. Another question, I said, well, the only way to really get rid of an audience is to alienate them. And for the first time I ever consciously pursued a course of action only because there were really no problems artistically for me to solve. It was a life problem. It was a social problem. And I solved it, number one, by only writing for dear friends. Well, it turns out that the dear friends were some of the finest musicians in the world, so I wasn't taking any chances there. So I wanted to eliminate the musician. Musician is a big problem. They dictate the taste. They dictate how much they could afford to rehearse, how much they want to rehearse. They want to play things that make them shine. They're not necessarily that gung-ho with the composer. Big problem with the performer. So I'm not thinking about the performer per se anymore. I'm just thinking about a few people who I know for the past 35 years. They're nuts about my music, and they play it beautifully. And the second problem is the whole idea of what is the real length of a piece. Given the opportunity, if you really want to write a piece and you're not thinking of an audience, you're not thinking of a performer, then how long is the piece? If you're not kind of unconsciously programmed that a half a side of a record is 20 minutes or 25 minutes, how long could this piece be? I then pursued this very fortunate direction, and my pieces became an hour and a half. And I wrote a string quartet, an hour and 40 minutes. And we got this marvelous quartet to do it in California. There was silence throughout the piece. There was never silence in a 20-minute piece of mine. But it was, you know, it was like Nicholas Nickleby, I suppose. They thought there was some kind of media event. And it was an hour and 40 minutes. I had a standing ovation. I was told I had a standing ovation with the same piece in Venice a year ago. Now in Toronto, I'm going to have my new string quartet is 2.5 hours. Now, wait a minute. What's really happening in this? I did one of these long things in Berlin. Anybody who's lived in Berlin knows that you're kind of a captive audience anyway, speaking of an audience, unless you go to the Academy of Kunst. You're out on the street or in a beer hall. So they just loved it. They just grooved on this hour and a half or 2 hour piece. And I noticed that the longer my pieces became, I started to develop a new audience. For whatever reason. All right, it might be too expensive for the, and it was only the expense of the Boston Symphony to do my new violin concerto, but an outfit like Frankfurt Radio is doing it. Doesn't seem to be a problem that it's an hour and a half and things like that. And I think these long pieces are going to develop a new type of audience that is listening, that wants to listen, and that needs to listen. Where, because intellectually, artistically, and certainly musically the past 25 years, unlike the audience with a capital A, being that they're the audience with a small a, they need it, you see. And if, so that was one formula where I'm getting a new audience, but quite by accident. Because I was really, I didn't know I was going to get a new audience. I just want to really get rid of the old audience. You know, it's like paying alimony. You just, it's as if you're never finished with it. The same 20-minute piece, 5 years go on, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the same attitudes. That's music in America. You know, Milton Babbitt, who's a very important American 12-tone composer, wrote an article, a very famous article in the States called Who Cares If They Listen? I really wanted to write one that really said, Who Cares If They Perform It? Because what's the point? What's the point of performing these things? It's like vote, it's like people in the sense I know, I have friends who are active in the Democratic Party. And I'm always very annoyed. They'll say, well, why don't you get active? I said, what do you mean get active? We're not going into the enclaves of people who are against our position. We're having parties and fundraising things amongst ourselves. I mean, we're already going to vote Democratic Party. So what do you mean by we should be active, you know, in this thing? And I think it's the same thing with a lot of composers, that we've created a kind of ghetto for ourselves only because we just can't cope with the problem, and we don't know how to cope with the problem. See, one of the ways of coping with the problem, for example, in Italy, is where the establishment puts on something avant-garde. And then because the establishment puts it on, everybody then has to cope with it. You see? And it will happen here, actually. There's very little audience for contemporary music in America. There's some of the audiences, I don't know exactly what the reason. I would say that maybe in a place like New York, there's just too much activity. I mean, every night there's just too much activity. Places like Paris, it's a little different. They're really big events. I know that in London, when I hear if I'm in town and the London Sinfonietta is playing, I see a lot of young people at the concerts, just as if it was in the 60s. I think the price of admission adds to it, rather than $15 that they would charge you in Carnegie Hall to hear Phil Glass or someone. $25 at the last concert, it was jammed. I would say that Phil Glass is a media rather than an artistic phenomenon in America. You know, America is essentially, the formula for America, and if you kind of take my word for it, then you never have to go there and you know everything about it, is essentially it developed, exploited, and invented middle brow. No place in the world, just think of it, in the popular songs from George Gershwin to Jerome Kern to Cole Porter. And they know how to update it without costumes like Chorus Line, you know. And America has two sides, that very swanky middle brow that unless you live there and know the kind of middle brow people that had a good education, got a BA, and are making a lot of money, and they don't, you know, they really want to have a good time, but they don't want to have a silly good time. They don't want to see Naughty Marietta, you know. And America was great at that. And their movies certainly are demonstrating it now. But there's another side of America, a fantastic side. It has two sides. And the sides, I would say, is deeply religious and deeply committed to exquisite values, like Thoreau, Emerson, the painters in the 50s. And those are the two Americas, actually. But what's happening in contemporary music is that the middle brow is winning out. Because there is a natural, it's in the DNA. It's the DNA. You know, you start off in graduate school, you're writing 12-tone music. How long are you going to write 12-tone music? You don't really have a feeling for it, and you kind of want to find your way, you know. And you finally wind up in this vast, open field, you see, a very high-class, middle brow type of music. Not something silly like London years ago would develop a kind of constant Lambert. We never had those types. We never had those types. kind of silly kind of music a little bit. And that's essentially America. Deeply spiritual, deeply, as it says, non-commercial in the true sense of the word. And commercial in the true sense of the word. That is making a very good competitive product. And the young people, in a sense, there's a new leisure class in America, the young, and they're a captive audience for these events. And Steve Reich, Phil Glass, in a sense, I feel, without insulting them too much, represent this, you see. And it's very attractive stuff. Very attractive. In fact, I wrote a letter to Universal, my publisher, about Phil Glass's last opera. And I said, you know, it's unfortunate that it has an avant-garde reputation because there's nothing avant-garde about it. What's avant-garde is that it's Soho and there are different kind of types writing it, you know. But in the letter I wrote him, I said, don't quote me. I said, Benjamin Britten could never have done it, and the damn thing should have opened up in Covent Garden, not in Brooklyn someplace, because it's sensational as theater, as entertainment, with the great middlebrow theme like Mahatma Gandhi, which is a middlebrow theme, and peace. Isn't it crazy how peace has become middlebrow? And it's just the right thing, right thing. And it's a fantastic thing to hear. Forget that it's simplistic and that certain parts sound like Verdi and some parts sound like Monteverdi. And that some parts sound like southern India. Forget about that. It's just terrific theater. And I think that one of the things against originality, also, it's so difficult. I think it's a kind, you know, like the hatred of the rich or the hatred of the poor. I think there's a hatred of the avant-garde or the hatred of originality only because it is so hard to do. And what are you going to do after Jackson Pollock threw the paint? You can't compete really with me or Boulez or John Cage as Anarchus. You'll be wasting your time. I mean, it's simply you're dealing with Chase Manhattan Bank. You're dealing with, you know, you're dealing with big power structures and trying to deal with these people. The only thing you could do is like Benita and just put it on the sign on the wall and saying, this is the enemy. You've got to remember that this is the enemy. At the same time that she's not a third world composer, so to speak. How does she exist in the midst of all these people? Rather than getting rid of them, you see, the way the media is and the way so many people are happy to. But you see, if you're not talking about broad issues and you want to give things names and you don't want to do things like that, then you see the conversation one could have is very, very difficult, you see, because then you really have to go out on the string and arrive at certain opinions about certain work and really, in a sense, forcefully, in a sense, support the work that you really believe in. And most people are pretty ambivalent about that. One of the things that I always do in my seminar, I'm so fed up with analyzing what something is and then having the student, when a recording of it is played for an examination, not recognize it. After writing an A paper of what it is, but not recognizing it when they hear it, and this has happened all the time again. Phasing me almost out of the university, is what I do many times, is if we hear a new piece by Takemitsu or someone else comes through, I don't ask, well, what is it? I usually ask, how good is it? Of course, no one. No one has anything to say. All my doctoral candidates, they have nothing to say, how good it is. And that's wherein the problem is in our particular time. So I think a whole new value system has to come about, you see. No one is really fighting for Steve Reich. You're writing about him, but you're not fighting for them, you know. The way you pick up the London, a London Sunday newspaper and see that idiot write some glowing article on Stockhausen again. The way it was at one time. Really going out for it, really, you know. Names. Who are the names? Where are the names? I only know two names, Benita Marcus and Joe Kondo. Both absolutely different. Absolutely. They have nothing to do with each other. Those are the only two names I know. And very envious of things in both. I'm envious in Joe Condell's lack of dependence on instruments, that he's picking out notes without instruments, which for me is inconceivable. Unless I know what instrument is playing a note, I don't know the note. But he writes these crazy, you know, just beautiful things. And very, very unusual type of way of working and thinking. The big problem is, and one of the biggest problems we're going to face this week, especially having composition discussions, in a sense, is that what develops that particular instinct to give someone's research or what one wants to do artistically in their music a certain degree of validity, what the great English psychiatrist Ernest Jones in his wonderful book biography on Freud has a marvelous section of how did Freud know and how could he find the cause and effect. You know. And he talked about Freud as this mineralogist to know that platinum was platinum and was gold was gold and this and that. That instinct to know. Again, that sense of material. What's needed. But not what's needed in terms of a society or a social structure or, you know, writing for your professor, or writing for an arts council, or writing for an audience. You see, how to work without that given and still come up with, you know, I understand that if we dig long enough, we're going to come up with something in this town. So how do we do that in our own work is essentially the big problem today. Not what's happening in Cologne and what is Cage doing these days and where do you think things are going and that kind of business. Because we've been talking about for the past 80 years, and evidently things have went really nowhere because it's essentially the same names, it's the same reason. And if it's not originality, which is a determining factor, then what? How do we explain the phenomena of what music travels and what music doesn't travel, you see? Outside of thinking of it as either a Jewish or a homosexual conspiracy against the composers in Chicago or Montreal, for that matter, or in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires can't figure it out at all, because the music has everything. It has rhythm, has everything, doesn't travel. In fact, someone told me that even the music in Montreal, by the time it reaches Toronto, it's dead. Very important factor. In other words, if you say originality is not the factor, then you can't complain if you don't travel. You see. And I hope we cover and argue and discuss this. You see. Where is the criteria? I give a seminar. I give a seminar about once every 3 years, and the seminar is called What's Allowed and What's Not Allowed. In it, I tally on a blackboard all the boogie, all the fantasies, all the notions, all the hallucinations that the graduate student think is either allowed or not allowed, you know. And it's actually a very fascinating thing. Okay, I've been very patient with my serious ramblings. Thank you.